Disc 4. The idea that young Marines like Mike and Harlan would foresee their deaths in battle, especially after experiencing combat, might seem a normal, even predictable thing, but in fact such thoughts are the exception to the rule. Almost all men in combat are convinced that the other guy is going to get it, not me. It's not natural to think that death is imminent and to continue to function normally. A surgeon who later served on Iwo Jima wrote a memoir that included a passage suggesting how rare were Mike's and Harlan's intuitions that they were going to be killed. As I slowly headed back north in my Jeep, one of the frequently used war slogans came to mind. Our Marines were willingly laying down their lives for their country. This statement was sheer nonsense, for the overwhelming majority of the men felt they would be spared, and that it was the next guy that would be killed or wounded. They had no intention of laying down their lives for their country or anything else. Each man believed he would be one of the lucky ones to return home. Those that lost or never did have this feeling of invulnerability would sooner or later crack up. Hilltop, Kentucky stirred when their Marine Franklin Sousley arrived home on furlough, proud with a new focus and direction in his young life. When Franklin came home, his friend J.B. Shannon, then a wide-eyed 13-year-old, remembers, it was a big deal for our little community. He stepped off the train in his Marine dress blues, looking straight as a string. He stopped at my house on his way home, Imogen Bailey remembered clearly years later. He looked so very handsome in his uniform. I took him out in my backyard and made him pose for a picture. I still have that picture today. Imogen helped Goldie cook Franklin's welcome home dinner as Franklin entertained his younger brother Julian with tall stories in the living room. On Franklin's last night home, he borrowed his aunt's car for a date with Marion Ham. He came over to my house and we visited, she remembered. We took a walk and he told me how proud he was to be a Marine, how excited he was to serve his country in the Corps. At the end of the night, he asked Marion to do what so many millions of World War II boys asked of their special girls. He asked me to wait for him. Franklin couldn't sleep after he said goodnight to Marion. He walked over to the Hilltop General Store. We sat on the porch talking until 3 a.m., his chum Aaron Flora remembered. Franklin told us how great it was to be a Marine. The next morning, Franklin said his sad farewells to his friends and family. They embraced and cried. He presented his mother Goldie with a copy of his formal Marine Corps portrait. Then Franklin stepped back. With a big smile, he looked Goldie in the eye and proclaimed, "Mama, I'm going to do something to make you proud of me." Later that morning, he said goodbye to Marion. On the back of the portrait he gave her, he wrote, "Picking a girl is like picking a flower from the garden. You only pick the best. Love, Franklin." His last words to his sweetheart were, "When I come back, I'll be a hero." At the train station, young J.B. Shannon just couldn't bear to say goodbye to his buddy. He considered riding the train to Maysville with Franklin, but it was a quarter each way, big money for a 13-year-old in 1944. But as Franklin was boarding his train, J.B. shouted impulsively, "Hey, Franklin, I'll just ride along with you." On the train, he told me he was just thrilled to be a Marine, J.B. remembered. He said he was right where he wanted to be in his life, in the uniform of the United States Marines. He said he was fulfilling his dream. In Maysville, J.B. waved goodbye as Franklin's train pulled out of the depot. "He was a hero to me, there and then," J.B. told me 54 years later. It was a battle on the tiny atoll of Tarawa in the Central Pacific that would foreshadow the fate of Mike, Harlan, Franklin, Ira, Renee, Doc, and all the Marines fighting America's war. Tarawa was a tiny one-square-mile spit of sand, only 800 yards wide. It was in the Central Pacific in the Gilbert Island Group, north of Bougainville and the Solomons. Tarawa represented the kickoff of Howlin' Mad Smith's Central Pacific thrust on the road to Tokyo, the dramatic opening of a second front in the war against Japan. This was a new theater of sand, coral, and volcanic rock that that left the jungles of the South Pacific far behind. The Central Pacific Campaign was unlike the battles in the South Pacific. The Japanese had heavily fortified these island outposts. To capture them, Marines would have to mount offensive thrusts into the teeth of an armed and waiting enemy. In 1943, there were reasonable military officers in the Pacific who expressed serious doubts whether any fortified island could ever be assaulted by amphibious forces. These men honestly believed the heavily barricaded enemy atolls of the Central Pacific would prove to be the burial ground of any American force foolish enough to leap off the deep end. Howland Mad Smith was not among those officers. He knew he was attempting the toughest of all military operations, a landing, if possible, in the face of enemy machine guns that can mow men down by the hundreds. He knew the battle would be costly in Marine lives. The Japanese had boasted that Tarawa could not be taken in 1,000 years. But Smith was confident his Marines would succeed. Huge Navy gunships hit Tarawa with the greatest concentration of aerial bombardment and naval gunfire in the history of warfare up to that time. The Navy admiral directing the bombardment even promised he would obliterate the island. But when the first three assault waves of Marines stormed ashore on the morning of November 20, 1943, they realized the Navy bombardment had been ineffective, had only rearranged the sand. Japanese gunfire ripped through their ranks. Confusion reigned. The Marines pinned down on the shore were in desperate need of reinforcements. Two waves of landing boats full of troops, tanks, and artillery were on their way. Then disaster struck. The landing boats hit an exposed reef 500 yards from shore and were grounded. It would be 44 years before physicist Donald Olson would discover that D-Day at Tarawa occurred during one of only 2 days in 1943 when the moon's apogee coincided with a neap tide, resulting in a tidal range of only a few inches rather than several feet. The actions of these Marines trapped on the reef would determine the outcome of the battle for Tarawa. If they hesitated or turned back, their buddies ashore would be decimated. But they didn't hesitate. They were Marines. They jumped from their stranded landing crafts into chest-deep water, holding their arms and ammunition above their heads. In one of the bravest scenes in the history of warfare, these Marines slogged through the deep water into sheets of machine gun bullets. There was nowhere to hide as Japanese gunners raked the Marines at will. And the Marines, almost wholly submerged and their hands full of equipment, could not defend themselves, but they kept coming. Bullets ripped through their ranks, sending flesh and blood flying as screams pierced the air. Japanese steel killed over 300 Marines in those long minutes as they struggled to the shore. As the survivors stumbled breathlessly onto shore, their boots splashed in water that had turned bright red with blood. This type of determination and valor among individual Marines overcame seemingly hopeless odds, and in 3 days of hellish fighting, Tarawa was captured. The Marines suffered a shocking 4,400 casualties in just 72 hours of fighting as they wiped out the entire Japanese garrison of 5,000. When the battle ended, Howland Mad Smith toured the island to see the Japanese defenses for himself. Because water lies only 4 feet below the surface of the Tarawa Atoll, the Japanese could not build underground defenses. Instead, they built pillboxes above ground. Smith, with other officers and time reporter Robert Sherrod trailing him, examined one of the 500 pillboxes on Tarawa. Sherrod wrote, "The pillbox is 40 feet long, 8 feet wide, and 10 feet high. It is constructed of heavy coconut logs, 6 and 8 inches in diameter. The walls of the pillbox are 2 tiers of coconut logs about 3 feet apart. The logs are joined together by 8-inch steel spikes shaped like a block letter C. In between the 2 tiers of logs are 3 feet of sand. Covering the whole pillbox, several more feet of sand are heaped. No wonder our bombs and shells hadn't destroyed these pillboxes. 2,000-pound bombs hitting directly on them might have partially destroyed them, but bombing is not that accurate, not even dive bombing. The message was clear. The Japanese were building defenses impervious to our bombs. It would take individual Marine riflemen on the ground to charge and neutralize these defenses. Looking at these Japanese defenses, Smith knew the Marines' road to Tokyo would be a bloody one. The distance between this first major amphibious assault on Tarawa and faraway Tokyo was over 2,000 miles. It presented an enormous challenge in terms of distance. In 1812, Napoleon had marched his men 1,500 miles to Moscow. In the 13th century, Genghis Khan advanced 4,000 miles from Mongolia to the shores of the Mediterranean, but those campaigns collapsed because of the distances. And now the Marines were faced with a campaign almost the distance from New York to San Francisco. A grief-stricken General Smith walked to the beach to view for himself young Marines floating face down in the lagoon and lying along the blood-splattered beaches. When American civilians later saw newsreels and photos of rows of Marine corpses floating in the surf, most were horrified. "This must not happen again," screamed editorials. And one mother wrote a commander, "You killed my son on Tarawa." Correspondent Sherrod worried that America did not have the stomach for the sacrifices the Marines would have to make to conquer the Pacific. To him, it was obvious that the Japanese strategy was to dig in on every island in the Central Pacific to inflict horrendous American losses in the hope that America would give up and negotiate a peace. The Japanese were counting on civilians to blanch at the human cost of advancing on Japan and for the Marines to falter in the face of the fanatical Japanese defenses. Yet, however much civilian support might have been in doubt, Smith had no doubts about the determination and bravery of his Marines. And at his last stop on the island, at the high seawall the Marines had to surmount to get onto Tarawa, Howland Mad saw an example of Marine valor. Sherrod wrote that the party saw a Marine who was leaning in death against the seawall, one arm still supported upright by the weight of his body. On top of the seawall, just beyond his upraised hand, lies a blue and white flag, a beach marker to tell succeeding waves where to land. Says Holland Smith, "How can men like that ever be defeated?" This Marine's duty was to plant that flag on top of the seawall. He did his duty, though it cost him his life. Semper Fidelis meant more to him than just a catchphrase. Tarawa was the first major amphibious assault in which the Marines faced sustained opposition on the beach. The American victory at Tarawa opened the Central Pacific to a new Marine thrust with more difficult amphibious island assaults ahead, and it made clear to Marine commanders that many more motivated and well-trained Marines would be needed to win America's war in the Pacific. So in March of 1944, the Marines issued new orders to six young boys who would someday be world-famous heroes. They were to report to a new camp to become part of a new Marine division. The great events in the Pacific began to draw the six flag-raisers toward one another. Soon veterans Ira, Harlan, and Mike, strangers at Bougainville, would be introduced to one another. They would be joined by three other strangers, Franklin Sousley, Rene Gagnon, and a non-Marine, a Navy corpsman attached to their unit whose name was Jack Doc Bradley. And as these six made their way to their new assignments, a tiny hill far out in the Pacific lay waiting. Chapter 5. Forging the Spearhead. If the Army and the Navy ever look on heaven's scenes, they will find the streets are guarded by United States Marines. From the Marines' Hymn. It was like a city, but it was not a city. At least it was like no city the six boys had ever seen or imagined. A low-slung city of men. Men and heavy machines and weapons and ammunition. Far greater in size and layout than any of their hometowns, it spread out in an olive-drab glaze over the rolling California land between Los Angeles and San Diego. Nearly every kid who arrived at the city's gates was awed. Camp Pendleton was so large, I thought there was no end to it, James Buchanan remembered. I thought it went all the way to New York. In the pre-war years, Camp Pendleton had been a small boot camp, a sleepy little base south of Los Angeles, named for Major General Uncle Joe Pendleton, the father of Marine training on the West Coast. In March of 1942, the Navy Department radically increased its size by acquiring the adjoining 130,000-acre Rancho Santa Margarita y Las Flores. Rancho Santa Margarita had consisted of canyons and rolling hills, livestock and grasses, and wild Castilian roses and low vegetation, rattlesnakes and fleas. The Pacific Ocean thundered against its westernmost perimeter. The new Camp Pendleton, with its isolated and rugged terrain, offered the Marines the perfect environment to harden their young men. The future flag raisers would spend the next 6 months moving about this untamed land, never sleeping in a barracks, never showering indoors, fighting raging wildfires, only occasionally sighting something as civilized as a dirt road. As one of their friends, Grady Dice, later told me, "We were in the middle of nowhere. All that was out there was rattlesnakes, sheep, and coyotes. We had to cut the tall grass with machetes." The new specialized city of specialized military men would mold a high-performing population that in traditional cities required generations to gestate. In fact, it would have to produce specialists of a level no civic society had ever required. Leaders who could make mass life-and-death decisions in split seconds, doctors ready to perform brain surgery at a moment's notice, mailmen delivering to no fixed address, priests whose duties overwhelmingly involve last rites, cooks who could serve customers by the thousands 3 times daily, and scores of record keepers, mechanics, drivers, dog trainers, and others, every one of whom would have to perform his duties in sync with the others in a spirit of total cooperation and under fire. Mostly, the city would produce men to return that fire and vanquish the enemy shooters. Its overarching purpose was to quickly transform Doc, Renee, Ira, Mike, Franklin, Harlan, and 21,000 others from standard-issue fighting men into an elite, interdependent martial society that would be moved intact across an ocean to fight an island battle. Camp Pendleton would see the creation of an entirely new Marine division. This new division, the 5th, had been activated on November 11, 1943, Armistice Day. In the ensuing months, its pell-mell assembly into a combat-ready force drew on all the energies and know-how of American industrialization. The urgency surrounding the 5th Division's creation was dictated by harsh military realities. The bloody Battle of Tarawa had demonstrated the need for many more Marines trained to rout out well-entrenched Japanese defenders. It would be at Camp Pendleton that the 5th Division learned the skills needed to prevail on the road to Tokyo. It was at Camp Pendleton, a crucible of that counteroffensive, that the 6 flag raisers first came together. They all swept in on the roiling streams of new men who flooded the unreal city every day. The men poured in by the truckful on convoys along Highway 101 and on crowded railroad cars clattering along an extension of the Santa Fe line. It was as though the American continent was being drained of its young men, and they were flowing here in great rivers. Mike, Harlan, and Ira reported to the camp at the end of their post-Bougainville furloughs. 40% of this new force would be composed of veterans such as they. Doc, Franklin, and Renee represented the remaining 60%, young boys just out of basic training. Doc came up in April from his crash course at Field Medical School in San Diego. Franklin arrived from boot camp in San Diego. Renee was shipped over from the camp at Charleston. He joined the military police company at the camp, but within 4 days on April 8th, Renee was shifted to a new company, a company destined for great hardship and for everlasting renown. This was Easy Company, a stinging irony given its fate. Easy Company consisted of about 250 men. They were divided into a headquarters or command section, three rifle platoons, a machine gun platoon to supplement the rifle platoons, and a 60-millimeter mortar section to back up the riflemen. Doc was one of two corpsmen assigned to the 3rd platoon, led by Lieutenant Keith Wells. Corpsmen remained technically within the Navy, but trained and billeted with the men whom they would watch over in battle. Mike, Harlan, Franklin, and Ira were in the 2nd platoon, led by Lieutenant Ed Pinnell. Its 40 members were divided into 4 squads. Sergeant Mike was a squad leader with 3 corporals reporting to him. One was Corporal Harlan Block, to whom Private First Class Franklin Sousley and Private First Class Ira Hayes in turn reported. Renee was in another of Mike's squads. Easy Company's boss was Captain Dave Severance, a tall, lean Wisconsin native, a ramrod Marine of exceptional judgment who had shown his mettle in battle, who expressed his authority through calm understatement and unflinching example. Easy Company was part of the 2nd Battalion, commanded by Colonel Chandler Johnson. The 2nd was assigned to the 28th Regiment, commanded by Colonel Harry the Horse Liversedge. The new fighting force soon received the honor of its own special moniker, Spearhead. Nearly 600 Marines submitted entries to design a shoulder insignia expressing this name. The winning design, created by a lieutenant named Fergus Young, was a scarlet shield and a gold V pierced by a spearhead of blue. Spearhead was a salute to the division's intended role in the grim island battles that lay ahead. When its training was complete, Spearhead would be thrust to the forefront of the great human tidal wave of hundreds of thousands of Marines fighting their way from island to island as it bore down inexorably on Japan. Spearhead would fight only one battle. The American High Command pinpointed this objective later, in the fall of 1944, although its location and identity would remain top secret. An ugly little scab of rock and volcano 600 miles south of the Japanese islands. And so its High Command, facilities, colors, and shoulder insignia squared away, Camp Pendleton began molding the assault force that would descend upon that ugly, as yet nameless, scab. Inspired leadership is a key to the Marines' greatness. Marine officers stress their duty to look after the needs of their men. The mythic Marine Chesty Puller once instructed his officers, "Whenever we are at chow time, the privates will be fed first, then the non-coms, and the officers last of all." Robert Leader, an Easy's 3rd platoon with Doc Bradley, shared his memories of his leader with me. "In the Marines, I never saw an officer take a drink before his men drank. Our lieutenant, Lieutenant Wells, would take heavy machine gun ammo off the back of guys who were struggling. Mortar shells are heavy, and Wells would take a couple from a guy to help. There was a loyalty between the men and the officers, between everyone. We knew our officers would go to hell with us." Joe Rodriguez, who was in the same fire team as Ira and Franklin, they reported to Harlan, who reported to Mike, reminisced about Mike's leadership. "Everybody idolized Mike. He was a born leader, a natural leader, and a leader by example. Harlan, Ira, Franklin, all loved him, even as Lieutenant, Lieutenant Pinnell, to whom Mike reported, stood somewhat in awe of Mike. He led by example. He had been there. He was an experienced fighter, but he never talked about himself. He had real concern for us. He was a big brother to us. We were young boys, and he would reassure us. He would say, 'I want to bring as many of you back home to your mothers as possible.'" Another good example of a leadership talent in the 5th Division was the semi-mythic warrior who would command the 28th Regiment to which Easy Company was attached. This was Colonel Harry the Horse Liversedge, a towering specimen from Volcano, California, who grew into a 6'4" Olympic shot putter and who in the war won a Navy Cross for his heroism in the jungle fighting at New Georgia. By 1942, he was a Raider commander. Now, 2 years later, he strode among the young boys of Camp Pendleton, an icon who was willing to wade once more into the horrors of battle at their helm. Harry the Horse's mission at Camp Pendleton was to mold his 3,400 men of the 28th Regiment into a flexible fighting unit. flexible, and that they had to be effective, whether they were fighting together as a regiment or as a number of small teams. Whatever he needed, a lone Marine to assault a blockhouse, a 3-man fire squad, a 40-man platoon, a 250-man company, a 900-man battalion, or a 3,000-man regiment, all his Marines had to be able to break off or come together as needed. Colonel Liversedge and the rest of the cadre of officers would assemble and polish its Swiss watch of a fighting force in several tightly calibrated stages. The training began with the simplest and most critical cog in the great fighting machine, the rifleman. First came the mastery of weapons. The boys had learned marksmanship and basic training. They had learned, often the hard way, that the Marines venerated the rifle. But now they began to understand that the rifle was the essential weapon of combat in this war. The Navy now held sway in the ocean. The Army Air Force was beginning to dominate the skies. But as Tarawa had shown, and as future battles were to show again, no amount of aerial bombing or naval bombardment, regardless of how obliterating it might look from a bombardier's sights or from the deck of a destroyer, was going to dislodge these deeply entrenched Japanese from their obsessively fortified Pacific islands. It was the riflemen sloshing ashore in the teeth of murderous fire. It was the riflemen surrounded by the screams and the floating corpses of his buddies. It was the riflemen scared and exposed and unprotected by armor of any sort, peering through the smoke and confusion for a glimpse of an individual enemy. It was the riflemen who would determine the outcome of America's war. The rifleman was the Marine counterpart of the Army infantryman. Every Marine, regardless of his ultimate assignment, would be trained with the rifle. The Marines even had a motto for it, "Every man a rifleman." Doc would learn the rifle even though he was a corpsman. Rene would learn the rifle even though he was a runner, a messenger. Mike, Harlan, and Franklin would be rifle specialists. As for Sturdy Ira, his weapon would be an advanced version, a Browning Automatic Rifle, or BAR. Long and heavy, it weighed about 24 pounds, the BAR could be fired either in single shots or in bursts. It held 20 rounds of ammunition, like a machine gun. It produced triple the firepower of a standard rifle. The BAR man was a popular guy to have around in a firefight. At Pendleton, the young Marines began to learn the complex choreography of rifle combat. They'd learn fire and movement, Dave Severance reminisced to me. We played war games. Two rifle companies would fire on a target while another company moved. Then they'd switch off and proceed toward the objective. Riflemen like Ira and Franklin doing what Sergeant Strank and Corporal Block told them to do. A key was protection. Fire groups protecting one another as they advanced to new positions. Jesse Boatwright recalled the emphasis on teamwork. "War is a team sport," he said. "From the private on up, you learn how to take orders and do what you're told. To work as a team, to obey the chain of command." The training was intense. It was about getting up at reveille and going up in the hills and playing war, Tex Stanton recalled. "We'd crawl and run around in the hills in the hot sun and then walk home. And tedious." "Repetitious and simple," Don Mayer remembered. "It was about doing simple things over and over so that you could do them automatically. And for real. We fired so much live ammo at Pendleton," recalled Grady Dice, "that we'd always be starting prairie fires. We were always fighting fires, even forest fires." By April, all units were drilling in the field, in the midst of physically draining tactical marches and 3-day bivouacs. Meanwhile, the division's many specialists would gain engineering expertise in state-of-the-art demolitions, map-making, landmine use, camouflage, and bridge building. Still others would receive intense training in communications, from enormous vehicle-mounted radio receivers to portable walkie-talkies. And every boy in uniform was expected to meet the highest standards in conditioning, on both dry land and in the water. Swimming was a heavily emphasized skill. Those who could not swim were taught how. Those who knew how were taught to swim better. As spring gave way to summer, Spearhead accelerated into the culminating elements of its training agenda. It launched into the first stages of amphibious training, conditioning these thousands of hard-bodied marksmen and technical specialists to move over the sides of troop transports into small landing vehicles, LVTs, and then to climb from these into shallow water and then onto enemy beaches, all under intense hostile fire. Here was where Spearhead's training began to conform most closely to its finely calibrated special mission. At Camp Pendleton, the troops got their first exposure to the terrifying skill of climbing over the rail and down the side of a skyscraper-sized transport ship and into the small LVTs. They worked with dry land mock-ups here, steep wooden walls covered with netting. Battle condition training would come soon enough. These exercises quickly gave way to full-fledged mock assaults. These games marshaled the division's 9 landing teams, each an infantry battalion with guns, armor, and other support elements. In early July, using transports that set sail from San Diego, these units participated in 2 landing assaults on San Clemente Island off the California coast. At the conclusion of the second landing, the troops immediately reboarded the transports and headed for their final exercise of the Pendleton phase, an assault on what their officers now called Pendleton Island, and described to them as a strongly held advance air base of the Japanese in the Western Pacific, a base that menaced U.S. forces. No one was saying yet just where that strongly held air base lay. It was during these final phases of training in July of 1944 that a distinguished visitor began to make himself visible at Pendleton. Many of the troops caught sight of him at a distance, observing them through binoculars, a figure wrapped in a dark cape sitting in a canvas chair beside an enormous black limousine. This was their commander-in-chief, come all the way across the continent from Washington to observe Spearhead, the legendary president whose fireside chats had kept some of these boys spellbound beside the radio with their families only a few years before. This was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Throughout the 6 months at Pendleton, all of Spearhead's boys, veterans, and new Marines alike, sensed a subtle but unmistakable new climate of respect from the brass. Gone was the ritualized domination of boot camp. These Marines were held to strict standards of discipline and physical endurance, but they were no longer mere recruits now. They were certified leathernecks. Crisp professionalism replaced dictatorial fury as the abiding mood of their universe. A year from their first action, the boys of Spearhead were already a brotherhood. Semper fidelis, always faithful. It meant you were faithful to the guys around you, is how Easy's Donald Howell put it. If you didn't have those guys around you in battle, you didn't stand a chance. With another Marine around you, you knew you had a chance. Robert Leader goes so far as to say this brotherhood involved a deep love. I believe we were out there fighting for our buddies. It's deceptive because we'd fight over a beer, insult each other's sister, but then we were ready to risk our lives for each other. It's like a domestic fight where the cop goes in and the man and woman at each other's throats moments before beat up the cop. No Marine would admit he loved another Marine, but it was true. We had a love for each other. My father typified this brotherhood in many ways. As the senior Navy corpsman of Easy Company, Doc had functional connections with the other 5 flag raisers. Though technically assigned to the 3rd platoon, in practice he supervised the 7 other corpsmen in the company. He would see to the needs of the entire company in combat. In this way, 2nd platoon members Mike, Harlan, Ira, Franklin, and Renee came to see Doc not only as a potential lifesaver, but as an integral part of their daily lives. He trained as a Marine alongside these boys and earned their respect as an equal in the service. His platoon commander, Lieutenant Keith Wells, would later give Doc and his fellow medics the ultimate compliment. My corpsmen were Marines. Mike Strank, an immensely popular sergeant who had some of the elan, if not the notoriety, of John Bazelone, had his own colorful way of expressing brotherhood. Mike was a prototypic big brother, a tough and fearless warrior who led by example, not by intimidation. Many young Marines idolized Mike, and Mike in turn softened his martinet's aura with frequent outbursts of goofy, profane humor. A lover of the weekly Liberty Leaves that sent the Marines flocking into nearby towns and bars for fun, Mike was amused at a necessary ritual that accompanied each Liberty, the mandatory testing for venereal disease of each man by a medic as a chaplain stood piously by. "You'd have to pull out your pecker and let them see if it was going to cry," was the way Tech Stanton described the testing for telltale fluids. And one day, Mike made up this poem about it. As Tex recalled the poem, it went, "Walk right in and don't salute. Down with your skivvies and out with your root. Skin her back and give it a squeeze. Do an about face and stand at ease." Another hazard of those environs, besides the clap, was the rattlesnakes. The rattlers had not been impressed by all the upheaval and the sudden onslaught of Marines. More than one trooper found himself frantically bashing a coiled diamondback with his rifle. One night, a rattler visited a tent occupied by Tex Stanton and Franklin Sousley, among several others. Tex chuckled over it half a century later. One guy reached up to get a bug off his neck, and it was the snake. He stood up all night after that. There were other less lethal annoyances. The men of the 28th Regiment were encamped in a section of Pendleton 10 miles from the ocean, cut by a dramatic canyon. The original Spanish settlers had named it La Cañón de las Rosales, or Rose Canyon, a gesture to the many wild Castilians that carpeted the area. But that name quickly gave way to another one, far more relevant to anyone who had actually camped there, Cañón las Pulgas, it came to be called. The Canyon of the Fleas. The fleas were only part of the fun. Mornings were ice cold, reveille at 6 a.m., and the water showers were colder. It rained a lot that spring, and the boys were often wet. Through all of this, my father was a calm center, a steadying influence on all the Easy Company boys around him. Just as the famous photograph showed him, there in the midst of things, lending a hand. At 20, he was already regarded as the old man among the corpsmen. He didn't socialize much, scarcely took a drink during Liberty. He made himself the company's unofficial barber, cutting guys' hair on request. Otherwise, he tended to stay in his tent, reading. When he wasn't crawling on his belly behind his platoon, that is. Most of his time was spent shadowing the riflemen, watching them maneuver, staying a little behind, alert for casualties. Doc, who Cabbage had recommended get a clean bunk in the Navy, would spend this year without sleeping in a real bed. His kindness became his trademark. A Marine named Lloyd Thompson had injured his back severely, but did not report to sickbay. Every morning, Doc Bradley would show up at his tent to help him with his boots so he could meet reveille. James Buchanan always remembered how Doc not only treated him for cat fever, but stopped him weeks later on a company street at Pendleton to ask him how he was coming along. No one else would do that, Buchanan said. He was kind. Father Paul Bradley, no relation, of Brooklyn, the 28th Regiment's Catholic chaplain, recalled that Doc Bradley volunteered to assist in serving his first mass at the camp, a typical gesture from my service-minded dad. I asked, "Does anyone know how to serve Mass?" the priest remembered. Doc came forward. He knew all the Latin responses. He continued to be very religious. A lot of the guys went wild, but not Doc. He was very faithful, attending the daily Masses. It was at Camp Pendleton that Doc Bradley met the doomed youth who would become his best buddy in the service, and perhaps a key to his lifelong silence on the subject of his World War II experiences. It was here that my father met Iggy. His full name was Ralph Ignatowski, and the name was nearly bigger than the boy who bore it. Like Doc, Iggy was a Wisconsin product, a baseball and bicycle kid, and the youngest of 9 children in a close-knit Milwaukee family with strong European Catholic ties. His father, Walter, was born in Poland in 1885, his mother, Frances, in Germany in 1890. Ralph was the favorite in a family that would produce a priest, Father Bruce, the second youngest, and 4 servicemen. "We loved him so much," his sister Julia said softly to me many years later. Like Rene Gagnon, Iggy was young, almost unthinkably young, to be in combat training. He was 17 during the advanced training at Pendleton, 18 when Iwu was assaulted. Like Franklin Sousley, he seemed to lack the temperament of a warrior. He was a sunny jokester, a warm-hearted family boy. His Marine photograph shows an intelligent, open, adolescent face, clear-eyed and confident, a handsome face in an affable, jug-eared way. But there was steel beneath that surface gentleness. Ralph had been determined to enlist in the Marines upon graduation from Boys Tech in Milwaukee in the spring of 1944, but the Marines rejected him because of problems in his urine sample. Ralph could have sat out the war, no questions asked, at that point. Instead, he returned to the induction center a few days later bearing a fresh urine sample. This one came from someone else. He made the grade. And Iggy was proud to be a Marine, as his brother Al Ignatowski related to me years later. I got a pass from the Army to visit Ralph at Camp Pendleton. I noticed a sergeant chewing out a young recruit. I told Ralph, "This is so different from the Army. You crucify these guys." But Ralph's chest just swelled with pride as he replied, "That's how we Marines do it." At Pendleton, Doc and Iggy gravitated toward each other and quickly teamed up under the Marines' buddy system. Although the Marines generally warned their troops against forging too many friendships, knowing that combat would rip huge, heartbreaking holes in these networks, the Corps recommended that each man identify one other who would be his close ally, eyes and ears, his alter ego in combat, and possibly the comforter of the other's parents. On this, the two Wisconsin boys formed their bond, a bond that quickly took on a comradely life of its own. They bunked together, ate ice cream together, went on liberty together, and generally came to know each other's deepest hopes, fears, and joys. Among the other beneficiaries of Doc's kindness at Pendleton was Ira Hayes. Ira's mother, Nancy, had been right. Something had changed in Ira after Bougainville, or, if not changed, brought to the surface, grown darkly dominant. The God-fearing good boy, the earnest, reform-minded son who had wept on hearing the sermon, "Alcohol versus Christianity," was slipping back into the grip of the vice that would war with his good instincts and foreshorten his life. He remained a good Marine, despite a growing paunch that made some wonder, mistakenly, about his endurance, and a respecter of Marines. He still cared about his good buddies and would care about them until the end. But his inner circle of good buddies was a narrow one. Mike, Franklin, Harlan, and Doc were among its key members, and those outside it trifled with him at their peril. Playful Franklin, who would become a foxhole comrade with Ira under fire, triggered Ira's edgy wit on their first meeting at Camp Pendleton when he asked him innocently, "What nation do you belong to?" "I'm an original American," Ira fired back. "And that's more than you can say." Ira respected Mike and Harlan because they, like him, were veterans tested by combat and the knowledge of violent death. His respect for Mike, in fact, bordered on adulation. He would talk to the Czech-born sergeant intimately and intelligently as he would to no one else. Mike Strank, many recalled, was the only person who could get Ira to truly relax. His bond with Doc was somewhat different. Like the other Marines, Ira sensed Jack Bradley's gentleness and goodwill. Doc, for his part, sensed the limits of Ira's tolerance and respected these. Clifford Langley, Doc's good friend and co-corpsman, recalled being on liberty in Los Angeles one night in Doc's company when they came upon Ira, drunk and surly, thrashing about in the grip of two military policemen. The two corpsmen talked the MPs into releasing Ira into their care, but that didn't end Ira's wayward night. "We couldn't control him," Langley said. "He was yelling, 'Get away from me! You can't tell me what to do!'" Doc finally said, "If he doesn't want our help, let's let him go." And we did. He got picked up by the MPs again and thrown into the brig. Ira often wore a poncho stuffed through his belt. It is visible in the flag-raising photograph in the Pima Manor. His bunk was usually sloppy, His shoelace is usually untied. Ira was mostly silent, and his mates could only guess his thoughts, except for Kenneth Milstead, who heard Ira's pain in the dead of the night. I would have guard duty with Ira often. We'd be sitting there alone, guarding some gate, no one around, just pitch black. Ira was always depressed. Over and over he'd repeat, "I have nothing to go back to. There's nothing waiting for me at home when I get back." It was just his nature to be depressed. He didn't talk much to most guys, so they couldn't tell, but when he talked to me, it was with his down-in-the-dumps attitude. I would just try to change the subject and get into something else. But his letters home frequently revealed a brighter side. In early July, writing from Tent City No. 1, he sounded for all the world like a kid at summer camp. "I'd rather stay in a tent than barracks. In the barracks, you have to keep your place clean all the time. What's more, we got wooden decks, 6 men to a tent, lights, and we have our own radio." By the end of the first week in August, his mood had turned fatalistic. "Well, I was offered another chance to go to communications school and be promoted fast and get away from this rough life, but I said no. My place is with a rifle. I didn't come in here to lead an easy life. They better get us overseas quick, and the war would be over with. Don't worry about me. I'm a man now, no young guy." The man now behaved a lot differently from the boy who had been impressed by the sermon on alcohol. George Scott of Easy Company remembered a late night after Liberty when he was sitting in the tent talking quietly with some buddies. Ira lurched into the tent and, without warning, hurled a bayonet in Scott's direction. It stuck in the ground. "We all looked up in silence at him," Scott recalled. "He just stood there scowling. I don't think he intended to hit me. He was just angry." He was generally angry. There was a chip on his shoulder. He was separated somehow. Perhaps Ira's unlikeliest pal was Franklin Sousley. Franklin arrived at Camp Pendleton bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, as his Kentucky people would have put it. A good old boy of 18, raw-boned and drawling, his rust-colored hair uncombed. He had grown physically formidable in boot camp. He stood 6 feet now, all of it muscle and bone, but the jokey sweetness was still intact. Franklin was as light-hearted as Ira was dour. He would have his new buddies in stitches within minutes, singing his homemade songs. His countrified Marine Corps hymn had become a minor smash around the camp, and now he had written a new tune, this one a half-comic, half-serious warble called "O Lord, Make Me Lucky, Take Me Home to Kentucky." When he wasn't vocalizing, Franklin was spinning yarns about the country folks back home, folks who lived in towns with names like Big Bone Lick and Dog Walk. "I never believed those names," mused Joe Rodriguez, "until I went there in 1982 and saw that it was true." His buddies loved to send up his countrified ways. He was the only one of the whole bunch, Bill Rannis liked to joke, who thought that K-rations tasted good. Kentucky and his home folk were never out of his mind. In July, he wrote a touching letter to his hard-working mother. "You wrote that you were sick. I want you to stay in out of that field and look real pretty when I come home. You can grow a crop of tobacco every summer, but I sure as hell can't grow another mother like you." Mike Strank added his own bawdy twist to the good-natured teasing of the Kentucky hillbilly. One Sunday morning, as the sergeant stood talking to some of his fellow veterans in the Easy Company compound, Franklin came loping into view. "Here's a good one," Mike whispered out of the corner of his mouth. Then, in a louder, conversational voice, he remarked, "Well, I got my masturbation papers today. Now I can go overseas again." Franklin, ever on the alert for inside lore, was all ears. "Where?" he wanted to know of Mike. "Do you get those masturbation papers? I want to go overseas, too." Mike was the picture of helpfulness. He directed the boy to the nearest officer in charge of records, and off Franklin charged, full of high hopes. Mike Strank functioned on many levels. He was a weekend drinker, a good time Charlie, and on Monday mornings he was all business again. He was widely regarded as one of the best squad leaders in the regiment. His squad, with Harlan, Ira, and Franklin in it, was also considered among the best in the regiment. His method was tough discipline leavened with gentleness. During the exhausting hikes up and down Pendleton's Canyon trails, just when the boys were groaning at the monotonous sameness of it all, Mike would call a halt, reach into his pack, and pull out a chocolate energy bar and carve it into small bits. "Here are your pills," he'd tell the boys, who were soon laughing. Robert Radabaugh loved the memory of the night Mike organized a seance in his tent. There was Strank, surrounded by a bunch of kids with their eyes squeezed shut and their hands suspended just above the surface of a card table. Mike had told the boys that he would make the table talk. He told them he would ask the table questions and it would respond by tapping on the floor. It was Mike, of course, who was doing the tapping. Few seemed to have much fondness for René Gagnon. One of the youngest and most sheltered of the Marines in the company, René had had little experience in the art of mingling with men, and he never really got a chance to develop it. His comrades in arms seemed to recoil from the slight, callow 19-year-old almost by reflex. They shook their heads at the pencil-thin mustache he sometimes cultivated and made him look like nothing so much as a little boy trying to disguise himself as a man. The memories of him among the guys of Easy Company are almost unremittingly withering. He seemed like a guy who didn't want his body hurt. I didn't like him from the moment I met him. He had an attitude of indifference, negative cockiness. He was looking for the easy way out. Ira Hayes was toxic in Renee's presence. Ira played solitaire, the card game of choice for this solitary boy. When René made the mistake of looking over his shoulder and intoning, "This goes on that," Ira leaped off the bunk and took a swing at him. And the men in his company could tick off a whole list of grievances. He had an irritating attitude. Nothing was ever right. Everything needed fixing. The food wasn't right. The entertainment wasn't right. The command wasn't right. Very negative. Very negative. It fell to Mike's strength to confront René's liabilities and turn this weak link into a useful integer in the chain. He rode the boy hard, pointing out every screw-up, making him the butt of his jokes and ridicule until Captain Severance finally noticed the problem and reassigned the boy as a runner, a messenger reporting to headquarters. It wasn't cruelty that motivated Mike. It was the larger goal of saving lives. And with the transfer, René remained a functioning member of the company. The other Marines were relieved, and René saw no problem in it. "I figured it would be a pretty good deal, getting the jeep and running errands for headquarters," he later said. Only on Liberty was René able to enjoy anything even remotely similar to a last laugh. "We used to take Gagnon with us on the town," Rodriguez admitted. "The girls flocked to him. He was real handsome. We'd get his leftovers." Harlan Block's tour at the advanced training camps was a period of inwardness for the hardy Texas athlete, diligent training and quiet contemplation. He kept close to Mike Strank, whom he admired, the ex-footballer who had once craved some of Leo Ryan's boards for his football pants, now adapted some of Mike's mannerisms. Like Mike, he wore his helmet cocked to one side. Like Mike, he disdained socks. Like Mike, he cultivated the strange habit of showering with his boots on. Privately, he continued to wrestle with his Adventist beliefs and their conflict with his military obligations, and with his conviction that from his next mission, he would not return. On a weekend leave, Harlan hitched up to Dos Palos, California, where Ed Jr. was in flight school to become a weather pilot. That night, as the two brothers sat at Ed's kitchen table under a single light bulb, Harlan told Ed that after his next assignment, he was not coming back. "He spoke as a patriot," Ed recalled to me. "He wasn't scared about it, but he told me he wasn't coming back." I tried to act like he was fibbing. I pretended that he was joking around. I said, "You're crazy, Harlan. You're not serious. Don't give me that." But he was serious. He wasn't joking around. His sister Maureen was the last family member to see Harlan alive. Harlan took a bus trip from Camp Pendleton to Loma Linda to visit her one summer day. It was on this visit that Harlan disclosed what he had been doing in the swamps back in Texas. If he got sick, he told Maureen, maybe it was God's will that he receive a discharge. But after God had not intervened, Harlan made up his mind that it was his fate to do his duty, never mind the torment he felt over the moral implications of battle. On the morning he left for Camp Pendleton and then the Pacific, Harlan told his sister what he'd told the others. Maureen, I'm not coming back. As the bus pulled out, she recalled sadly many years later, I had the strong intuitive feeling that Harlan was right and I would never see my little brother again. In their half year at Camp Pendleton, the Marines of the 5th Division had survived fleas, rain, cold, hot sun, bad food, and rattlesnakes. They had learned all that the officers and facilities at the surreal City of Men could teach them. Now it was time to board some ships and sail off into the ocean toward another training facility at a destination as yet unnamed and learn some more. On September 19th, Franklin's birthday as it happened, the Marines left San Diego Harbor in troop ships. Their voyage would take 2 weeks. Many of them would never see their American homeland again. But all of them would get a glimpse of paradise before the firestorm to come. And yet a second massive, specialized city within that paradise. Paradise, Hawaii, looked lush and green and inviting from the rails of the ships, dropping anchor in Hilo Bay. Few of these American heartland boys had ever seen anything quite so exotic. One Marine later remembered it as a huge hunk of green jade shimmering in the dark blue of the Pacific Ocean. From the cars they boarded on a narrow gauge railroad bound for their new camp, they could see waterfalls, pineapple plants, fern jungles with their brilliant flora, wild parrots screeching in flight. This was the Big Island, Hawaii itself. Their arrival, however, burst the illusion and brought them back to Earth. Dusty, hard-scrabble Earth. Spearhead's final destination turned out to be yet another training camp forged from what had been a ranch. This was the former Parker Ranch, the largest cattle empire on American soil. At the outbreak of the war, its owner, Richard Smart, agreed to lease its 40,000 acres to the Marine Corps for $1 a year. Its first major use had been as a respite for the battered and fatigued 2nd Division after the Battle of Tarawa in 1943. The Leathernecks quickly renamed the grounds Camp Tarawa, and the name held through the remainder of the war. Camp Tarawa sprawled across terrain that lay between two volcanoes, Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, whose snow-capped peaks were visible from the hundreds of pyramid-shaped tents soon erected there. The camp was 65 miles away from the town of Hilo and 16 miles from the beach. And on this side of paradise, at least, the landscape was a far cry from Eden. Shiny slabs of black rock, ossified lava flow, covered much of the ground. Coating the rock were layers of volcanic dust that spiraled up in the whipping wind that never seemed to abate, getting in the boys' eyes, flavoring their food. Oh, Camp Tarawa was a miserable place with those lava rocks and constant dust, recalled Roy Steinfort. The Red Cross judged it unfit to hold prisoners there, so it was a perfect place for the Marines. As to the food, the troops in training would enjoy none of the beefsteaks that the Parker Ranch had sent out to an appreciative America. We were on the biggest cattle ranch and on Hawaii, one of them later recalled. But we never got beef and no pineapple juice. Instead, they would take sustenance with a nightly meal that someone dubbed SOS, for shit on a shingle, creamed mutton on toast. Sometimes, for variety, they got mutton meatloaf or mutton stew. A local woman, a cook named Sugi Kayama, came to the rescue of the boys' palates with an inviting delicacy, juicy hamburgers. Each day, Sue, requisitioned a steer from the slaughterhouse and fed it through her gas grinder. The steak and rib sections added greatly to the flavor, as did her addition of celery and breadcrumbs. The Marines queued up for Sue's Burgers in line so long that the townspeople gave up on joining them. One day, Sue spotted a boy who looked like a local, a Hawaiian, perhaps. When he reached the counter, she asked him if that was true. No, the boy said. He was an American Indian. He introduced himself as Ira Hayes. Here, in the final 4 months before the Great Armada departed for its still top-secret destination, for the Japanese island known only as X, the Marines would fine-tune the ultra-specialized skills they would need for their great challenge. They would learn how to disembark, take the beach, turn left, and cut off the mountain. Disembark hardly suggests the lethal difficulty of the first component in this sequence. It entailed the stomach-wrenching, terrifying process of climbing down the webbing of cargo nets pitched over the sides of the great transport ships, every step of the climb encumbered by heavy packs, and securing a seat in one of the smaller landing crafts that would carry the men into the shallow water and to the edge of the beach. The young men were forced to make their descent as the huge transports bobbed and yawed in the turbulent waves. Some lost their footing and plunged into the water. Others found themselves painfully jammed against the ships by a sudden collision of hull against hull. My father told me about the challenge of this experience once when I was a young man. It was one of the very few times he ever spoke of his wartime life, and that fact made it even more memorable to me. He told of clinging for dear life to the webbing, trying to choke back nausea and disabling terror as he followed the back of the next Marine down. I kept saying to myself, if he can do it, I can do it, my father told me. So much of what all these boys would do over the next month, so much of their survival, so much of their sanity in the midst of murderous chaos would come down to just that, following the back of the next Marine. If he could do it, they could do it. The maneuvers at Camp Tarawa, with its obsidian terrain and its access to the pitching Pacific surf, were designed, as far as was humanly possible, to make the troops live out the assault on Iwo Jima before they got there, to live it out in their reflexes, their instincts, their dreams. The ideal result of Tarawa was that, once in combat, the boys would not have to think, would not have the mental option of making a wrong move. They would already have done it, psychically speaking, all their lives. While the boys trained and retrained, their colonels and generals plotted strategy according to specific orders they had received from Washington at a secret conference at Pearl Harbor. The officers dissected and reconfigured this strategy inside a forbidding-looking wood structure next to division headquarters, a building that bore the deceptively innocuous title of the Conference Center. The conference center's windows were blacked out, its shut doors sealed with double locks, its premises cordoned off with barbed wire, and the constant presence of armed MPs. No one could enter the conference center without a special pass. It was inside this dark edifice that a small training staff was told in November of 1944 that Island X was Iwo Jima. Fred Haynes, on Harry the Horse's staff, remembers how the training changed at Camp Tarawa after they secretly studied the maps of Iwo Jima. We knew we would land on Green Beach, right under Mount Suribachi, and we knew we had to cut Suribachi off. We found a volcanic hill about the same height as Suribachi, about 550 feet high. We took tennis court tape and marked off a beach around this Suribachi. We then rehearsed the men landing on this Iwo and getting them across the island to cut off the mountain from the rest of the island. We had the riflemen, the flag raisers would have done this many times, form into a boat team of 25 or so men. Each of these teams lined up a distance away as if they were at sea, headed for the shore. They walked together until they hit the tape, beach, and then deployed. The 1st Battalion went straight across the island, while the 2nd Battalion, with Easy Company, had to swing around immediately to the left, and together they would take the hill. We wore out thousands of pairs of tough rubber shoes going over that rough volcanic rock practicing this. We had a hard time keeping the troops in shoes. After all the serious practice, Ira Hayes still managed to recapture a vestige of his Pima youth on Camp Tarawa. With his friend Ed Castle, he would go looking for horses to ride during rare moments of leisure, an easy task on the vast ranch land if one was not afraid of riding bareback. There were no saddles, Castle recalled, so we'd stand on a rock and jump on the horse's back. You had to hold on to the horse's mane so you wouldn't fall off. Ira was a very good rider, and he loved to ride bareback. He talked then about being free and roaming the plains when there were no reservations. Franklin could not get lucky. He could not get home to Kentucky. So he found a way to bring a little bit of Kentucky to Tarawa. Bill Rannis smelled something highly peculiar in the company's tent one day in the general area of Franklin's cot. More than peculiar, something downright rotten. "What's that smell?" he asked Franklin. Franklin looked around to make sure they were alone. Then he motioned Rannis to come over to the cot. Silently he raised the blanket to reveal a tub filled with a foul-scented dark mush. "What?" Rannis asked. "Is that?" "Raisin Jack," Franklin answered proudly. It was, as Rannis soon learned, an alcoholic mash that the young Kentuckian would later strain through a filter to make drinkable, a kind of moonshine. He'd appropriated the raisins from the kitchen while on KP duty, he explained to Rannis, and he'd added a little yeast, and then waited while nature did the rest, an old folk skill that he'd brought with him all the way from the Appalachians. "He was real proud of that Raisin Jack," Rannis remembered. My father passed his days at Camp Tarawa, attending to his duties and thinking of home. From what his friends recalled of him, he clung to his characteristic serenity and the exceptional focus that would guide him through his long and happy life in Wisconsin. A dream burned in his heart, even as a hell on earth brewed on the other side of the ocean. A clear, simple dream of returning home and opening his funeral home. Through all the turmoil that was about to engulf him, he never lost sight of that dream. Robert Lane remembered Doc's tranquility in those days. "He was more mature than most guys," Lane said. "He never participated in the drinking bouts, and he used to tell me how he handled people who were suffering the loss of a loved one. He had already done that often in his life. In the funeral business." In November, the men whose home states authorized absentee voting were allowed to cast their ballots in the general elections, but most of the boys were too young to vote. By that month, infantry regiments were running 72-hour maneuvers as fighters and dive bombers roared overhead. The practice landings continued and continued. It was in November that Harlan Block made the gesture that would underscore his bond with Bell. The 5th Division announced a plan to make National Service life insurance policies available to every man in the ranks. Harlan purchased a $10,000 policy. The beneficiary was Bell. Not Ed, and not both his parents, as would have been routine, but Bell. In doing so, he ensured his mother's comfort and freedom in the years beyond his death. Harlan wrote his mother a letter in November, a few weeks before the ship sailed. In it, he imagines what it would be like to be home. "Let's see, the early oranges are already gone, the naval oranges, too. About another month and you will be selling the ruby reds," he asks after the football buddies he enlisted with in a group. "Are the rest of the guys that came in when I did okay?" Thinking of Christmas, he mentions the girl he is convinced he will never see again. "Buy Catherine Pierce a present for me and send it out to her. Get anything that would be all right for the occasion. You know more about that than I do." Harlan instructs Belle to buy all the kids something, and "Dad, don't forget him." Then the boy focuses in on his mother and becomes, in his fantasy, her Santa. "Above all, don't forget yourself. Just go down and buy yourself a new hat, coat, dress, and shoes, and purse. Use as much money as you need." December 1944, the last Christmas for too many young boys. then off for the 40-day sail to Iwo Jima. The boys of Spearhead had been expertly trained for 10 months. They were proficient in the techniques of war, but more important, they were a team, ready to fight for one another. These boys were bonded by feeling stronger than they would have for any other humans in their life. The vast, specialized city of men, boys, really, but a functioning society of experts now, trained and coordinated and interdependent and ready for its mission, will move out upon the Pacific. Behind them, in safe America, Bing Crosby sang of a white Christmas, just like the ones he used to know. Ahead lay a hot island of black sand, where many of them would ensure a long future of Christmases in America by laying down their lives.
End of Disc 4.